At once, from all sides, he's jeered, "Shut the freaking door!" Clouds of snow explode about him. Fugitive flakes land and quickly vanish on the bare, hot skin of a wave of sweating, dancing couples a few feet beyond. He takes his coat and hangs it in a small side room with hundreds of others pretty much like it. He ventures into the main room. He looks around and sees lights everywhere, pin spots, lasers, scanners, moving yokes, all dancing in sync to the roaring music that throbs from all sides and surges. The air glitters with swirling colored floating flakes suspended in a world of sound and light. He stands stunned. He has passed into another world, in the full glory of its passion, while the world outside, the real one of snow, wind, fire, and bullets, fades, if only briefly. Dressed more like a vagrant than someone out for a night of clubbing, he mixes unmarked among the busy throng, borne by the tide and passes unseen along until full in the center of the floor. He looks about in awe. Above him, the open atrium rises 4 or 5 stories. The interior is the size of a football field. The walls are rough red brick. All around, in the scant light above, he sees balconies. Everything is wood, brick, and wrought iron. The place is windowless except for the few near the entrance and the dark, reflecting skylights high in the exposed, massive wooden rafters above, where fairy lights are set in starry constellation. On the main level is a vast, sunken central dance floor. Above this is the open atrium to the beamed roof aloft. At the south end of the polished bar, furthest from the stage, rises a pulpit-like, semicircular array of flickering flat computer screens, behind which stands a tall, long-haired, geeky guy in a black t-shirt emblazoned in white with the logo Ibabtu. The console array faces northwest, diagonally across the expanse of the club. From this perch, the guy in the black t-shirt has a ruling view of the entire scene. Suspended by many steel cables from the rafters high above and centered over the dance floor is a crisscross array of black-painted steel beams. From these hang 8 massive black speakers and a huge array of electrical equipment, spotlights, lasers, and yokes of all sorts. Dangling from unseen cords, huge disco mirror balls spin. They glitter and flash in the multicolored pin spots from the central lighting array. Attached to the balconies all around are even more, endless racks of lights and lasers. Then sudden cheering rises from the crowd as lasers flicker brightly through the dark. Blasting chords of music engulf the hall. Air guns flash in bright bursts of light and smoke, shooting glitter into the vault above. Aloft in air unseen and mixed with night, this airy, weightless mist of mylar flakes flashes in the wildly splaying lasers. The sound builds and the crowd begins to dance. Retreating to the bar, he finds a stool at the far end near the computer pulpit and orders a scotch and soda. Swiveling around and facing towards the dance floor, he leans back to survey the scene before him. Fully 300 people are in attendance, he guesses, and still relatively early. After a few moments, he leans to one side and asks the guy on the stool next to him, "Say, do you know if this is David Shea's place?" The guy turns, looks a bit quizzical, and with a sweeping gesture across the room replies, "Yeah, dude. This is Shea Davids. Really something, ain't it?" A bartender places a basket of pretzels on the bar between Mike and the guy he's talking to, then nods to the geeky guy at the computer console. A hidden wireless mic activates. "My name's Mike. Mike McAnaeus. I'm Steve Smith. Do you have any idea where I can find David? Do you know where he lives or when he's here?" "Oh, yeah, he lives here, man. Way up there," as he points towards the dimly visible rafters several stories above. "What do you mean?" "There are penthouse apartments up there, man. David and some other people work here, live up there." "Where?" "See, up there, around the sides. You can see the balconies." "How do you get up there?" Geeky bartender in the black t-shirt eyes Mike suspiciously and begins typing on his keyboard. Quickly, an invisible infrared targeting laser, then several unseen cameras focus on Mike. "Oh, see that door over there? Down at the south end of the wall? Beyond the main entrance? There's a freight elevator behind it. You go up that way." Mike shouts over the sound system, "Here, let me buy you a drink and tell me more." The guy at the console scans Mike's fingerprint, taken from a used glass, and begins processing it against a database, along with the data from Mike's driver's license captured by the bouncer at the door. After a few minutes, he text messages the results throughout the club's encrypted wireless network to others around the dance floor and to David, who's sitting at the main control console of a massive computer room a floor above. David scrutinizes the images being captured by the security cams. Mike plies Steve for information for the better part of an hour and 3 double gins and tonic, until suddenly he hears a great roar behind him. He turns to see an explosion of pyrotechnics and mylar glitter shoot from air guns. Over on the far side of the club, people are jumping up and down, cheering and waving. The sound system plays a brassy fanfare as Mike asks his new, somewhat drunk acquaintance, "What's going on?" "That's probably David," shouts Steve. "He usually makes an appearance around now to introduce the bands." David faces the applauding crowd as shrill whistles pierce the smoky air. He holds a wireless microphone to his mouth and says, "We've got a great group here tonight, all the way from Kansas City. And if it doesn't snow stop snowing. They may be here until April, so I hope you like them. I want you to welcome for their first trip to Omaha and their first Nebraska blizzard, the incomparable Prairie Mayhem. The crowd screams their approval in return. David waves his arm low as the members of the band jog on stage, taking bows. David trots off the stage. The building shudders as the first guitar chords burst forth from the speakers, both on the stage and suspended from the girders above. The lasers, keyed to the sound system, splay thousands of pencil-thin colored beams in the vault above, creating a luminous canopy of light. After more belches of pyrotechnics and several more Mylar confetti blasts, the evening's entertainment commences. David makes his way over towards the bar, shaking hands and saying hello to some of the regulars. The other end, Mike takes leave of his seriously drunk new friend, who's clutching the bar for balance and looking like a deer staring down a Peterbilt. He threads his way through the crowd. As David spots Mike, he does an abrupt but insincere double take, thrusting his arms to each side and shouting, "Hey, Mikey, Mike McAnaeus, is that really you?" They converge and shake hands as David continues, "I can't believe it. How the hell are you, man? What are you up to? How did you get here? How'd you find me? Hey, David, it's been a while. I see you've lost your fear of crowds," replies Mike, smiling. "Well, sorta. Still get a bit nervous every time I introduce a band," says David. "Come on down to the end of the bar where it's a bit quieter. I think the band's trying to shake the snow off the roof. They may succeed." They head towards the south end of the bar, back near the computer pulpit. David turns to the geeky bartender in the black t-shirt and says, "Hey, Todd, how about a glass of scotch over here? The good stuff." Then turning back to Mike, he says, "So, dude, what have you been up to? What brings you to the Riviera of the Midwest?" "I came here for the surfboarding." "More like snowboarding, if you can find a hill." "Yeah, well, maybe it was snowboarding. There are definitely some gnarly drifts out there." "Yeah, totally tubular, and the frostbite is free." Todd, the guy in the black t-shirt, brings the drink and places it on a white napkin and says, "Here you go," then returns to his computer terminals. "So again, what brings you to Snowmaha? People don't often make surprise visits during blizzards." "Omaha? I came to Omaha for my health." "What do you mean, health? We're in the middle of a freaking blizzard on the prairie. Nobody comes to Omaha for their health, at least not in January. What's the real story?" he says, frowning a bit. "Well, I'm kinda in a little bit of trouble and sorta hiding from some people who would rather see me a little on the dead side of the ledger. That kind of health." "Oh," says David with a new level of interest. "Yeah, so I figured I needed to disappear for a while, and this just might be the best place to disappear, too. Geez, who the hell would look for anyone in Omaha, for Christ's sake?" "Well, you found me here. So tell me, have you finally discovered your true calling in life and run off with the mob boss's daughter or something?" No, not exactly. "He doesn't have a daughter, but he does have one hell of a bad temper." "Oh," said David, raising his eyebrows. "Todd does, too." "Yeah, oh," says Mike sheepishly. "I get a feeling we need to talk, right?" "That's probably a good plan," says Mike. "Come on, let's go upstairs. It's a bit quieter and there's a few hundred fewer people hanging around," says David as he takes his drink from the bar, turns and says to Todd, "We'll be upstairs." Todd frowns and says, "Okay, are you sure?" "Yeah, it's okay. Better get ready for some sleepovers. I don't think any of these people are even going to go through the motions of trying to make it home tonight." Todd nods and says, "Way ahead of you. We've already got the cots and blankets out of storage. They're stacked up out back and I'm thawing some stuff out for breakfast." Mike follows as David leads him around the side of the club and over to the far corner door to the freight elevator. They enter a large enclosed room. As the heavy steel fire door closes behind them, Mike hears the discreet clicks of bolts automatically sliding into place. On one side is an old wood-floored freight elevator, the size of a bedroom. In its open cage, a single naked light bulb hangs from its roof and swings slowly in the draft from above. The exposed walls are old, pocked, rough red brick. On the other side is a sliding metal door to an outside loading dock. It hangs on wheels set in a greased track above and slotted into a metal rail below. The poorly insulated room is cold. The rising and falling wind outside rattles the heavy steel loading dock door. The squalls wail dissonantly through the cracks between the steel door and brick wall and combine with the muffled rumbles, thuds, and distant filtered notes of the band on the stage outside. Above the elevator cage, the shaft extends into darkness. "Right this way, if you please," says David, jerking up the old worn wooden gate. As they step onto the elevator, the floor bounces slightly at their newly added weight. The gate drops behind them with a thud. Mike's eyes flicker about apprehensively. "Don't worry, it's safe," says David as he punches the top button on an old worn brass control panel. Solenoids clatter, followed by the piercing whine of large electric motors spinning up. The clutch engages, the floor lurches, the cage rattles, and they're jolted upwards. Shadowed bricks and steel beams pass quickly in the dim light of the cage's single light bulb until the motor quits and unseen metal brakes wrest the elevator to an abrupt halt. Mike staggers a bit at the sudden braking. David pulls the gate open, and they exit onto an apex of balconies. Behind them, the gate drops with a bang.